Today is Monday, April 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
The U.S. is designating Iran's Revolutionary Guard as a foreign terrorist organization.
We'll have more on this story coming up. Also ahead, Israeli voters head to the polls tomorrow in a national election, and witnesses and security officials in Libya say a warplane carried out an airstrike on Tripoli's only functioning airport today. It's all on today's International Edition. Israelis vote in a national election tomorrow. Polls show that veteran Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, seeking a fifth term in office, is best positioned in the tight race to win and head the next government. His decade-long dominance of Israeli politics has been the biggest issue of the campaign. Recent polls have shown that the right-wing bloc led by Netanyahu will win a majority, but they also show a new centrist party headed by a popular former general emerging as the largest faction in parliament. Surveys detect many undecided voters who could swing the election either way. Well, witnesses and security officials in Libya say a warplane carried out an airstrike on Tripoli's only functioning airport today, following UN calls for an urgent humanitarian truce in the country. Security officers at Matiga Airport, east of the Libyan capital, said that no side had yet claimed responsibility for the attack, which hit the runway but caused no casualties. The airport then was shut down. Forces loyal to military commander General Khalifa Haftar have been continuing a push aimed at taking the capital. Libya's UN-backed Prime Minister Fayez Sarraj has called the action by Haftar an attempted coup. Haftar and his forces appear to have gained ground along the outskirts of the capital, but Sarraj said government troops are prepared to confront them. The UN issued an urgent appeal for a two-hour truce in the suburbs of Tripoli to evacuate civilians and those wounded. Well, the UN Refugee Agency and partners are scaling up emergency preparations to help hundreds of thousands of Rohingya refugees withstand a second monsoon season in Cox Bazar, Bangladesh. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Every day, an estimated 5,000 Venezuelans flee violence, persecution, and socioeconomic distress in their country. Most have taken refuge in Colombia, which is hosting more than 1 million Venezuelan refugees and migrants. There are no refugee camps in the country. Those who arrive are hosted by local residents or are forced to live in makeshift shelters or on the street. The UN Refugee Agency says the new reception center, the first of its kind in Colombia, aims to provide the most vulnerable people with temporary shelter, food, water, basic medical care, and other services. UNHCR spokesman Andre Mahecic says the center initially will be able to assist 350 people, but has the capacity to expand and accommodate more people in the future.
Macau is one of the cities in La Guajira with the highest concentration per capita of refugees and migrants from Venezuela. Hundreds of people, including children, the elderly, persons with disabilities and critical medical conditions, are forced to live on the streets due to lack of alternative shelter options.
Mahecic tells VOA Venezuelans who have no documents are among the most vulnerable. He says those who cannot prove their identities have difficulty in getting the aid they need. He says they face many risks from unscrupulous people ready to take advantage of their difficult situation.
They may end up basically turning to the streets, to the coping mechanisms that may involve child labor or other forms which are the negative coping mechanisms, and certainly that is the possible exploitation and abuse that we are looking at.
More than 3.4 million Venezuelans are living abroad. Most have left their country since 2015. The United Nations is appealing for $738 million to provide life-saving assistance to 2.2 million Venezuelans and 500,000 host communities in 16 countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, embattled U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen was forced out rather than resigning willingly, several U.S. news outlets are reporting. Nielsen, who also gave a short press conference earlier today, submitted her resignation yesterday after meeting at the White House with President Donald Trump, who almost daily has voiced his anger at the thousands of undocumented Central American migrants crossing the southern U.S. border with Mexico to seek asylum in the U.S. The news accounts in Nielsen had no intention of quitting when she arrived to meet with the U.S. leader, but that he was determined to ask her for her resignation, which she submitted shortly after the meeting. Immigration hardliners in the White House, including National Security Advisor John Bolton and Immigration Policy Advisor Stephen Miller, had been pushing Trump to oust her, viewing her as not tough enough to deal with the crisis at the border. Meanwhile, thousands of young children were taken from their parents and held in separation facilities, often in less than ideal conditions. Nielsen was responsible for executing that policy while at times denying there was such a policy. Well, also following this story very closely and joining me in the studio is VOA's Eleni Barros, who has been to the border recently. And thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so what can you tell me? What did you observe when you were there?
So the last time we were there, we talked to families waiting to present themselves at a port of entry. That was in El Paso, Texas, which is where Trump has gone in the last few days. We spoke with people who just told me we want to come here and work, or some of them wanted to reunite with families here, you know, either a mother with a child saying, oh, my husband and my eldest child's already in the U.S., they already stable, they're already going through whatever process they're going, we want to meet them here in the U.S. So I saw a lot of that. I saw a lot of single men as well, one gentleman from Cuba that had made his way through Ecuador, stayed at Ecuador, and they came here, and I asked him if he knew what was waiting for him, that he would be detained and for amount of time that it's unknown. And he said that it was worth it because he wanted to work. He was a chef. So we heard from different people saying, and mostly women and children saying that they, you know, needed to run away from violence because their kids were getting to that age where gang members were recruiting. So, you know, 7, 9, 10-year-old. So then you make the plan to make yourself, like, go to the U.S. border.
So when they come here and they're detained, what exactly is involved in these detention facilities?
So we are not allowed to go inside of the detention facilities, but we can go around them and talk to people outside, and sometimes they hold press conference. It depends if you are a family unit or if you come as a single man or a single woman. If you were a family unit, children cannot be held in detention because of the Flores Agreement, which stipulates an amount of days that they have to be in a family, quote-unquote family facility, held for some time, and you go through the screening and all that, and then you're released with one of the organizations nearby who becomes your sponsor. But that's a family unit. That's a mother with children, male, a man with, you know, children. And CBP and ICE, they have to verify if those kids are actually, you know, with their parents. So there's a whole process. If you were a single man or single woman, you might be detained. You might be detained indeterminately. You might be sent to different detention centers. You might start at the border. Then they might send you to another place. It really depends on the case and really depends who is your officer, who is screening you, who is interviewing you. It depends of what kind of proof you brought with you. If you're a woman and you're running away from domestic violence, for instance, and you brought with you, you know, all documents that, hey, I went to the police. I tried to go to another country. Like one of the women that we interview, she had gone from Guatemala, she had gone to Honduras, and her ex-husband kept following her. So she had, like, all proof that she went to, you know, police and talked to police officers, and they didn't do anything. She gave me, you know, her whole story. So it really depends on the case.
And do you see this as a crisis?
Look, with the experts that we talked to and the people that we saw there and then we interviewed, they saw it as a humanitarian crisis, mostly. You have people running away from persecution. You have people who have been waiting in ports of entry. And you have to understand, when you're waiting for 5, 6, 7, a week, weeks, and you're desperate with kids, depending on who is around you, they might push you to cross in between ports of entry. And then most of those families, they just give themselves up. They just wait for Border Patrol to come and pick them up. Okay. So mostly a humanitarian crisis for a lot of people.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for that information. I appreciate sharing that experience. That's VOA's Eleni Barros, who was joining me here in the studio. Among the top stories in the world, the Japanese automaker Nissan has ousted from its board former chairman Carlos Ghosn and another executive American Greg Kelly, who are facing charges of financial misconduct. Authorities in Afghanistan say the latest military-led offenses have killed nearly 100 Taliban insurgents and injured dozens more in a bid to reclaim full control of a volatile district in western Bagdis province. And Uganda's president Yoweri Museveni offers reassurances that his country is a safe place to visit after security teams rescued an American woman and her driver who had been kidnapped by gunmen in a national park. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. The U.S. is designating Iran's Revolutionary Guards, IRGC, as a foreign terrorist organization. In a statement, U.S. President Donald Trump said this unprecedented step, led by the Department of State, recognizes the reality that Iran is not only a state sponsor of terrorism, but that the IRGC actively participates in, finances, and promotes terrorism as a tool of statecraft. The IRGC is the Iranian government's primary means of directing and implementing its global terrorist campaign. Associated Press reporter Sagar Meghani has more.
The U.S. is designating Iran's Revolutionary Guard as a foreign terrorist organization. America has never before used that designation for an entire foreign government entity. President Trump says the move recognizes the reality that Iran's a state-sponsored terrorism supporter and the Revolutionary Guard's an active player. While the administration says the move will further isolate Tehran, the designation could have big implications for American military and diplomatic personnel in the Middle East and beyond, since Iran has threatened to retaliate. Sagar Meghani at the White House.
25 years after the Rwanda genocide that killed about 1 million people, Rwanda is perceived to have risen from a devastated nation to a country described by the World Bank as a nation that has achieved impressive development gains. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about Rwanda's development model and whether it would work elsewhere in Africa.
There isn't a single consensus on what Rwanda has done on its development efforts, but the popular narrative is that Rwanda has invested in its public infrastructure by securing grants and loans, and in that way it's been able to create and modernize some of its infrastructure. It has controlled corruption to enable it to use these resources for these public goods. It's helped to reform its private sector, making it easier to start new businesses, and it's made its financial sector and banking more accessible to the general public. So all of these things have contributed to steady economic growth over the last 20 years, which has contributed to rising incomes overall, decreases in poverty, including measures like infant mortality rates and child mortality, and improvements in literacy.
How crucial was reconciliation to the development experience in Rwanda?
The issue of reconciliation is still ongoing within Rwanda. And I think there's differing opinions on how far this has come. Indeed, one of the common criticisms in Rwanda is that its human rights record continues to lag behind. There is regular reports of the government harassing critics. People have been jailed, intimidated. Some opponents have been assassinated. There's little room for political participation. Independent media is highly controlled. And so as a result, the debate about reconciliation is really obscured, because what we hear is just the government's perspective that reconciliation has proceeded, it's completed, and Rwanda has moved past an ethnically based society. But if you look beneath the surface, many people would argue that indeed a lot of the tensions that led to the genocide remain in place.
Would Rwanda's development model work elsewhere in Africa?
Well, if you look at the general principles of what is properly seen as the development model in Rwanda, controlling corruption, public investments in infrastructure, reforming the banking sector, and facilitating creation of new businesses, for sure, these are general principles that can be applied elsewhere in Africa. You know, the premise that is often made in Rwanda is that they've had to take a repressive governance stance to do so. And I think that's the false premise that confuses the discussion about the Rwanda model. There are a number of other African countries that have performed well economically and developmentally during the same time period, countries like Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, Mauritius, Namibia, Botswana, and they've done so without the same repressive governance style that we've seen in Rwanda. And in fact, if you look back over the last 20 years and you compare the performance of Africa's democracies, they've actually grown at a rate that's about a third faster than autocracies in Africa, and they perform better on a host of development indicators as well. So the premise that there's this trade-off between a repressive government and better development, I think, is a false premise. And if you look at the positive elements of what Rwanda has done, I think these can be replicated elsewhere.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA's senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy. Well, the UN Refugee Agency reports thousands of Venezuelans are risking their lives by fleeing to neighboring countries via irregular, dangerous pathways because official crossing points are no longer available to them. We go once again to Lisa Schlein reporting for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Venezuela officially closed its land borders with neighboring Colombia and Brazil nearly 6 weeks ago. The move, however, has not deterred thousands of Venezuelans who leave their country every day. UNHCR spokesman Andre Mahecic says the journey has become more perilous. He says many people are wading across swollen rivers or risk being exploited and abused by armed groups controlling treacherous, irregular paths.
On Tuesday, security forces on both sides of the border struggled to control the situation as some 46,000 desperate people forced their way across the Simón Bolívar International Bridge between the Venezuelan town of San Antonio de Táchira and the Colombian city of Cúcuta. With heavy rain having swollen the river and flooded many of the footpaths, the only viable option for most Venezuelans was the bridge.
Mahetra says people are moving in both directions. He says not everyone who crosses the bridge remains in Colombia. He tells VOA many Venezuelans cross into Cúcuta every day just to pick up items they cannot find at home.
It may have been buying some food or maybe purchasing medicines, things that they cannot find in Venezuela right now, and then they head back. Not necessarily everybody will continue to Colombia or other countries beyond Colombia. So this has been the situation for a very, very long time.
Mahecic says the pileup of people on the Simón Bolívar International Bridge created a very scary situation, with many people panicking as they feared being crushed. Fortunately, he says, no one was hurt. But he says the risk is always there. Mahecic says the situation is an example of the dangers of irregular cross-border movements. He also says it shows the extent to which people are willing to risk their lives in hopes of finding a better alternative to their situation. The oil-rich country's economy has contracted sharply in recent years, and inflation has exceeded 2,000,000%. The dire economic conditions have fueled malnutrition and disease and triggered an exodus of more than 3 million citizens since 2015. Embattled Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro contends his government has been victimized by an economic war led by political opponents. He blames past U.S. financial and oil sanctions for the country's economic crisis. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. This is VOA's International Edition.
On our- our voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about, sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower, and change the rules. It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka. Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Well, on the sidelines of 2 days of events marking the 70th anniversary of the founding of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, the United States signaled a bilateral defense cooperation agreement with Hungary, an act that went almost unnoticed by American media. Hungarian media, however, widely published the news on Saturday, quoting Hungary's Minister of Foreign Affairs and Trade, Peter Szijjártó, as saying this is a modernized version of an agreement reached 20 years ago. In a statement, David B. Kornstein, U.S. Ambassador to Hungary since June 2018, says this agreement will modernize our previous status of forces agreement to reflect new realities in defense. Daniel S. Hamilton, a transatlantic expert at Johns Hopkins University, explains to VOA that the agreement serves as a means to channel U.S. funding to signatory countries under the European Deterrence Initiative. In rare public comments, Australia's spy chief has said the nation faces a list of security threats that is almost endless and greater than ever before. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Nick Warner is the head of Australia's newly created Office of National Intelligence, which aims to coordinate the work of the country's security agencies. Warner says Australia is confronting between 90 or 100 current security risks. They include threats from terrorism, both right-wing and Islamist extremism, tensions between China and the United States, regional unrest, and North Korea's nuclear program. There is a warning that territorial disputes and a trade war between Beijing and Washington will have an effect on Australia, which has close military ties to the US but has relied on commerce with China for its recent prosperity. There are concerns too that the defeat of the group calling itself Islamic State in Syria could mean that foreign Islamic militants could return home to Europe as well as Australia and Southeast Asia. At least 30 Australians are reportedly housed at a refugee camp in Syria following the fall of the ISIS stronghold in the town of Baghouz. Warner says Australia's intelligence community is facing unparalleled challenges.
Australia's strategic environment is changing quickly and significantly. Australia is facing some of the most challenging strategic circumstances that it has for decades. The world is more complex, and arguably the world is more dangerous than it was. I could give you an almost endless list of challenges.
Closer to home, Warner sees emerging challenges with Australia's nearest neighbour, Papua New Guinea. Its population of 7 million people is expected to soar to 20 million in the next 2 decades, putting immense stress on natural resources such as water and also electricity supplies. Australia has 10 intelligence agencies. Its national terrorism threat level is at probable. It indicates that individuals or groups have the intent and capability to carry out an attack in Australia. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. Thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Thomas Blondet. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.